Good afternoon. You're listening to Travailleurs Non Travailleurs dans la Rue, CKUT's labor radio show. Today I'll be interviewing David Blakeney, who is the National Union Representative of the Canadian Union of Postal Workers. We'll be talking about the current state of trade union social activism in Canada. Welcome, David, and thank you very much for being on our show.
Thank you, Peter.
David, could you give an overview of the current state of trade union activism in Canada? What kind of activities are the bigger unions, such as the FTQ, CAW, QP, and CUPW, currently involved in?
Well, geez, that's a pretty broad question. I mean, I'll leave alone the FTQ. It's just not my place to comment. I really don't know a whole lot about the situation, labor situation. In terms of the sort of cross Canada, the unions you mentioned, the CAW, QP, and others, I think there's some positives, and if I were frank and honest about the status of the labor movement today in Canada, I would say there's some negatives as well. Of course, the positives are worker, in spite of many years of neoliberal policies and attempts to crush unions and reduce their power, the governments haven't been totally successful. Workers still organize, they still bargain collectively, and they still fight for their rights. And, you know, that's a good thing. And that's not something that we see want to fall by the wayside. And also I'd have to say that that unions have also come out, you know, against this impending war, which is, again, a good thing. In the past, and Yugoslavia and other cases, unions haven't really been there. A number of unions haven't. So on some things, unions are showing a really progressive bent. And that's a good thing. But I think also that if we are honest about the trade union movement in Canada, we'd have to say that we've allowed a lot of stuff to go on that's pretty nasty to workers, to the poor, to Indigenous people, and that we haven't reacted to because we're pretty much have our noses, you know, sort of hunkered down into sectoral bargaining, you know, bread and butter issues, which is important for a trade union, but also places you at risk of being bought off and isolated and so on. So I think we've got a long way to go in terms of mobilizing against a whole range of injustices that occur, whether the injustices are directed against immigrants, whether it's harassment of people of color, whether it's just, you know, police out of hand, you know, a whole range of issues, public housing, the right to have a decent meal, access to education, all those things. I think unions are key to using their collective power to mobilizing people to fight for.
Yeah, David, I'd have to definitely agree with you. And why do you mentioned sectorial issues, that unions focus basically on sectorial issues? Mm-hmm. Why is that focus so strong when, as you mentioned, there's so many other issues that unions could be dealing with? For example, I was in Quebec City, as I'm sure you were too, and why did the unions march away from the fence at Quebec City?
Well, I don't think, for one thing, that in general, and again, I'm speaking with the Canadian unions and not the ones inside Quebec, I think they followed the lead of the FTQ, sort of in someone else's backyard, and that's what we do. Also, I don't think the unions were prepared for the confrontation. I don't think they prepared their members. I think it's been typical and historical for many decades in general for unions to sort of bus their members, mobilize their members and bus them somewhere, hear a few speeches, and that's it. And in the world today, mobilizing a few thousand folks to stand in a field and sing some nice songs and hear some good rhetoric doesn't change things. Governments understand that. Corporations understand that. The bottom line for them is money and power. And so I think unions have to get back to targeting money and power rather than nice, you know, kumbaya sessions in football fields and that sort of thing.
Sure, and maybe I'll reiterate that question again. Why do you think they're afraid to do these things? What's holding them back?
I ask myself that question a lot, and is it? And I don't know the answer to that. Is it that we don't want to change the system. Is that the reason? Is that really what it is, that we think the system's just fine, it just needs a little tinkering with, but we don't really want to sweep away the sort of capitalist system? Of course, that doesn't get said. The other part isn't that we feel, yes, the system has to go, it's corrupt, it's evil, it hurts people, it's nasty, but we don't know how. We don't know how to mobilize our people to do that. But that doesn't get expressed either. And I think both of those things have to be put on the table. Is it that we really don't want to change the system, and that we're going to constantly look for social democratic leaders that will somehow lead us to the promised land and then disappoint us? Or is it that we feel inept? And if we feel inept, there's no shame in that. You know, let's put it on the table and talk about it.
Yeah, I think perhaps the first option that you mentioned might be the truth, in the sense that perhaps unions, you know, represent an aristocracy of labor,
mm-hmm.
and in essence, they do quite well under the capitalist system. So perhaps that's why they're scared to rock the boat.
Well, and then also just looking at various models of trade unionism, like let's take the Canadian Labor Congress, you know, of which we're a member, and which, you know, we should be. We should be in a family of workers where we communicate and have dialogue. But on the other hand, you know, this is a body representing, what, some 2.3 million workers with four elected positions. And so you have a situation, too, where unions are run by staff that aren't accountable to the membership, that have never worked a day in the workplace, that the people that they're representing, and in general make salaries far beyond and have rights and benefits far beyond what the workers they represent have. So I think equalizing that would be a start. If people, you know, representing janitors knew that they were going to get paid what janitors paid to represent them, it might sort of separate the wheat from the chaff a bit, I think, you know, and make it more real. But you're right. I mean, we have almost like a managed system. And if you look at unions, who they communicate with, and I can tell you this from years of experience in trade unions, even, I guess, relatively a progressive one, we spend more time communicating with our employers than we do with our members. I mean, when you look at all the consultations and letters that go back and forth and phone calls and grievance arbitration hearings and meetings and consultations and negotiations, those are with employers. Those aren't with members in a workplace building vibrancy and power. They are, in a sense, a dialogue with the employer constantly. Well, employers know this. Employers know that the more paper they throw at us, the more letters and meetings and consultations, that our focus becomes them and this dialogue with them rather than a dialogue with their membership. And that's happening all over. And historically, right. When unions are at their most powerful, they're in the workplace.
Right. I've had direct experience of that kind of thing working in a union shop where the union, in this case the CAW in an automobile plant, felt very much like part of the management structure. They were just really part of the system.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It happens all the time, and sometimes it happens without even knowing about it. And I think that's a tragedy, and I think that for things to change meaningfully in this country and around the world, and particularly in the North, I mean, workers have a huge responsibility in the North. We benefit off of theft of resources from not only in our lands but around the world. We have a duty to take this on, you know, and when that day comes, I think that's when we'll see change. And at the same time, I don't think we can write off the labor movement and say it's irrelevant, because, you know, workers have a lot of power. They have their fingers on the buttons of production. And we could end this tomorrow. We could end this tomorrow if we'd stand united around this stuff. And this is where the sectoral bargaining comes in, because employers know, well, you know, what's it going to take? What's it going to take how many crumbs do we have to give to shut these guys up? And governments work the same way.
Absolutely, David. Now, David, you're a highly active member of the PGA, People's Global Action.
Yeah.
And the PGA is an umbrella group that brings together Canadian groups such as OCAP, mm-hmm. That's the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, and the CLAC as well, Convergence sure. des Luttes Anticapitalistes,
mm-hmm.
With other similar groups abroad.
Sure.
And does the PGA provide an alternate action model for Canada's trade unions?
Well, you know, you're right. I mean, PGA is a network, and it can, it could. I mean, the model I see fundamentally is either we're against capitalism or we're for it, and that's where the difference is, I think, in where the axe kind of falls. And I don't know. I don't know trade unions. I mean, one would hope. I mean, I think to win and really change society meaningfully, we've got to abolish the capitalist system. We've got to abolish exploitation of human beings. And fundamentally, that's the question. And that's why I think the PGA Network is a good one for us. Although there are contradictions, we continue to bargain collectively with their employer, and sometimes, you know, we don't take things on that we could take on because we have other priorities. But I think it's important that we be connected to a movement that is fundamentally anti-capitalist in nature. And I say this because, you know, our membership at a convention, you know, over 500 delegates representing around 45,000 postal workers voted to be involved with PGA. They said, yeah, the system sucks. We should be connected with social movements. It's not just about unions anymore. It's about all of us. It's about farmers in India. It's about peasants in Bolivia. It's about the Maori in New Zealand. And it's about the little postal worker freezing their butt off in northern Manitoba, you know? It's about all these things, and I think building those interconnections is where the trade unions have to go.
Right. Well, how would you contrast the PGA to the World Social Forum, which you said you'll be taking part in Brazil coming up soon, I think, in this month?
Yeah. Well, I think it's always good when social activists get together, no matter what stripe. But I think fundamentally, again, it's the notion of the system, and we've got to address it. There's no mitigating capitalism. We've tried that. There's no mitigating it. It has to be abolished, and I think that's the difference between the World Social Forum and PGA. We'll participate in both, and we feel we have a role in both. We feel that, for example, the trade unions through the World Social Forum are promoting what's called core labor standards. That's basically an accommodation of the WTO. It's saying, well, you know, recognize workers' rights around the world, and we'll recognize you. Well, workers' rights don't mean shit to me if I don't have a job. And we all know that workers' rights will be used differently against developing countries than they will be here. For example, we have child labor in Canada. Well, you know, I don't think Canada's going to face much global censure or boycott or harassment. But if a 14-year-old boy in India is apprenticing on their traditional farm that has been in the community for thousands of years, then, you know, one could see that would be created as a ruse to attract other parts of the Indian economy. So, and I think unions have to be cognizant of this, and this is where I think the difference lies. We have to recognize that the capitalist system is not designed for the welfare of the majority of human beings. It's just not. And we can do better than this. What has capitalism done? It's been an abysmal failure. Billions of people in abject poverty. You know, the environment polluted. We don't even know if our water is safe anymore.
And it's getting worse all the time.
Yeah, and the fact that people profit off that, they make money off our water not being safe. And you have a situation where water costs more than gasoline. It's just, I mean, I don't see that that capitalism will lead us to any kind of equality. And in fact, it'll lead us to more misery and perhaps threaten the entire survival of the planet. So there aren't many years left, and I think that accommodating, asking, begging, pleading, looking for crumbs from the power holders is a real mistake. And PGA doesn't do that. Groups, and I don't speak for PGA, but I know that the groups that in that network, and if you look at the PGA manifesto, it says that enough's enough.
David, I'm going to ask you one more question.
Sure.
I want to ask you about trade union activism against capitalism in the third world. Is there hope there? And could you say that the movement in the third world is more advanced? And I know that's a pretty large and general question, so I'll just get you to hopefully comment on that briefly.
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's been a history. Of course, the AFL-CIO has created institutes like the American Free or the American Institute for Free Labor Development, which is basically a cover to develop anti-communist trade unions and trade unions that were involved in the overthrow of democratically elected governments like Allende's in Chile and others. So,
or in Venezuela currently.
Yeah, in Venezuela currently, where you have the leader of one of the federations, you know, basically in hiding and cavorting with the rich oligarchy who have robbed and pillaged Venezuela for decades and sent their money abroad. So I think it's a bit of both. I think you have mass popular movements like the Fisher Peoples in India, the Karnataka State Farmers Union, who burned the Monsanto fields to the ground in India a few years ago. Those are very militant fighting worker organizations. And on the other hand, you have bodies that for decades have been dependent on northern money for their development and basically acquiesce to the American Federation of Labor or the ICFTU, the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions. So it's a bit of both, and I think, you know, it's not about unions organizing workers, and I think that's a mistake we make in the North. We always think, you know, the unions have to organize workers. I think, you know, a friend of mine was saying, no, workers have to organize their unions.
David, I'd really like to thank you for being on the show.
It's a pleasure.
And hopefully we can talk again some more at a later date.
We'd love to.
Okay, thanks again.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.